Today we're going to be looking at the life of Ahaz. You can turn to 2 Kings chapter 16. To get a little background, we'll go to a few verses in 2 Kings chapter 15, right toward the end. And it talks about Ahaz's father, Jotham. Verse 32, Jotham was the son of Uzziah, king of Judah. And it says that in verse 34, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. He did according to all that his father Uzziah had done. In other words, he did things that were right. Verse 35, however, the high places were not removed. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. He built the upper gate of the house of the Lord. Now notice that Ahaz's father did what was right, but the people were still sacrificing and burning incense on the high places. But then it says that in those days, verse 37, the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. So Jotham rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father. Then Ahaz, his son, reigned in his place. So you can see that in Jotham's day, God brought judgment by means of Rezin of Syria and Remaliah's son Pekah of Israel. Now Ahaz, who was next in line, you can see there at the end of the chapter and then beginning of chapter 16, that Ahaz didn't heed this rebuke, but pursued the evil of Israel's kings and practiced heathen abominations. The summary of his reign is that it was evil. It says there in verse 2, Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God as his father David had done. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Indeed, he made his son pass through the fire according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. So do you notice the specific evils that he was involved in? He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, in other words, walking like a heathen. He made molded images for Baal. You can find that by looking at 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 2. If you want to hold your finger at 28, we'll look there various times. He made his son pass through the fire. In fact, you find in 2 Chronicles 28, verse 3, he burned incense in the valley of the son of Hinnom. And he was like the heathen that God had cast out. He didn't learn from history. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. You can see he's a leader in false religious activity. And he is one who is leading his people into wickedness. And so God brought preliminary judgment against him and his people by bringing Rezin and Remaliah's son. And he was able to withstand the attack against Jerusalem. You can see that in verse 5 of 2 Kings 16. It says, then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to make war, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. At that time, Rezin, king of Syria, captured Elath for Syria and drove the men of Judah from Elath. Then the Edomites went to Elath and dwell there until this day. Now, you can see he's able to withstand some attack, but he's having some losses. Well, in this kind of crisis, Isaiah came with a message of hope. So, turn to Isaiah chapter 7. Isaiah chapter 7. It says, it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it. And it was told to the house of David, saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim. So his heart and the heart of his people were moved as the trees of the woods are moved with the wind. You can see they're having quite a crisis. And God sent Isaiah the prophet. Verse 3. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out now to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Yashub, your son, at the end of the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, Take heed and be quiet. Do not fear or be faint-hearted for these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria, and the son of Remaliah. Because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have plotted evil against you, saying, Let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves, and set a king over them, the son of Tabeel. Thus says the Lord God, It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years Ephraim will be broken, so that it will not be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. Now notice that even though Judah was afraid, there in Isaiah 7:2, God sent Isaiah with a message of hope, verse 3. And this child's name, Sher Yashub, means remnant shall return. Now that sounds ominous, doesn't it? But he's saying in verse 7, don't be afraid. Their counsel against you will not stand. Ephraim will be crushed within 65 years, verse 8. And the key, verse 9, is believe in God. If you do not believe, you will not be established. Now, the word you there is plural. If you do not believe, you will not be established. In other words, the focus is on the nation. And Ahaz might have thought, well, 65 years won't help me too much. I'm liable to be dead by then. I want some help right now. Well, God even invited Ahaz to ask God for a sign to increase his faith. Notice verse 10 and following. The Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, Ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Then he said, Hear now, O house of David. Is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. And he talked about a son that's to be born, called Emmanuel. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. The Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house, days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. Now that sounds pretty ominous too. Notice that God offered to give him a sign, and he arrogantly refused, giving this pious-sounding answer. And God says, I'm going to give you a sign anyway. And then he's speaking about a child. Before this child is old enough to refuse the evil and choose the good, something is going to happen. And that seems to point to at least a young woman present in chapter 7, verse 14. In other words, the judgment is going to come soon. And then, chapter 7, verse 17 and following, God promised that Assyria is going to come against him. I'm going to bring Assyria against you, your people, your father's house. And it's going to be unlike anything that has occurred since the time of the division of the kingdom. It's going to have great devastation and thoroughness. Look at verse 18 and following. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the farthest part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. They will come, and all of them will rest in the desolate valleys and in the clefts of the rocks, and on the thorns and in all pastures. In the same day the Lord will shave with a hired razor, with those from beyond the river, with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the legs, and will also remove the beard. It shall be in that day that a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep. So it shall be from the abundance of milk they give that he will eat curds. For curds and honey everyone will eat who is left in the land. It shall happen in that day that wherever there could be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it will be for briars and thorns. With arrows and bows men will come there, because all the land will become briars and thorns. And to any hill which could be dug with the hoe, you will not go there for fear of briars and thorns, but it will become a range for oxen and a place for sheep to roam. I mean, it's talking about devastation of the land and just left to grow up in weeds, briars and thorns. What a mess. It shows that most of the people are gone. Just a few people are left, and there's cattle there so they can eat curds, drink milk. Well, now remember, Rezin and Pekah warred against Ahaz, but they couldn't overcome him, according to 2 Kings 16, verse 5. But Rezin drove Judah from Elath, 2 Kings 16, verse 6. But now turn over to 2 Chronicles, verse 28, and you'll get a picture of the devastating things that were happening. 2 Chronicles 28, beginning at verse 5. Therefore the Lord his God delivered him into the hand of the king of Syria. They defeated him and carried away a great multitude of them as captives and brought them to Damascus. Then he also delivered into the hand of the king of Israel, who defeated him with a great slaughter. For Pekah the son of Remaliah killed 120,000 in Judah in one day, all valiant men, because they had forsaken the Lord God of their fathers. Zichri, a mighty man of Ephraim, killed Maaseiah, the king's son, Azrikam, the officer over the house, and Elkanah, who was second to the king. And the children of Israel carried away captive of their brethren 200,000 women, sons, and daughters, and they also took away much spoil from them and brought the spoil to Samaria. Now that sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? Pretty severe defeat. Verse 9. But a prophet of the Lord was there, whose name was Oded, and he went out before the army that came to Samaria and said to them, "Look, because the Lord God of your fathers was angry with Judah, he has delivered them into your hand, but you have killed them in a rage that reaches up to heaven. And now you propose to force the children of Judah and Jerusalem to be your male and female slaves? But are you not also guilty before the Lord your God? Now hear me, therefore, and return the captives whom you have taken captive from your brethren, for the fierce wrath of the Lord is upon you." Then some of the heads of the children of Ephraim, Azariah the son of Johanan, Berechiah the son of Meshillemoth, Jehezekiah the son of Shalom, and Amasa the son of Haldai, and Amasa the son of Hadlai, stood up against those who came from the war and said to them, "You shall not bring the captives here, for we have already offended the Lord. You intend to add to our sins and to our guilt, for our guilt is great, and there is fierce wrath against Israel." So the armed men left the captives and the spoil before the leaders and all the assembly. Then the men who were designated by name rose up and took the captives, and from the spoil they clothed all those who were naked among them, dressed them and gave them sandals, gave them food and drink, and anointed them, and they let all the feeble ones ride on donkeys. So they brought them to their brethren at Jericho, the city of palm trees. Then they returned to Samaria. Now notice what happened here. The attack from Israel and Syria, many captives to Damascus, verse 5. Pekah killed 120,000 valiant men of Judah in one day, verse 6. And Zichri of Ephraim killed Maaseiah, the king's son, and Azrikam, the officer over the house, and Elkanah, the second in command, verse 7. And they had 200,000 captives, women and children, that they took to Samaria, plus spoil, verse 8. And the only reason that wasn't fully carried out was a prophet came and warned them about God's wrath, and so they gave up their captives. It was God's mercy to the northern kingdom, and also to the southern kingdom. Now, what is happening to Ahaz? Ahaz had opportunity to trust in the Lord. God said, "I'll give you a sign," and he refused it. So God gave him a sign that he had devised. And then, evidently, Ahaz is not paying attention to God. He's devising his own schemes. Because instead of trusting in God, he is taking a policy that is in direct opposition to what Isaiah has said. You remember Isaiah says to him in chapter 7 of Isaiah that if you will not believe, you surely shall not be established. He is choosing not to believe. And so, at some point, Ahaz is bribing the king of Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser, to attack Pekah and Rezin. Glance over at 2 Kings chapter 16, verses 5 to 9. In this part, you see that when Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah came up to Jerusalem to make war, they besieged Ahaz, and it talks about how they couldn't overcome him. And then in verse 7, so Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel who rise up against me. So you can see he is becoming a vassal to the king of Assyria. And what did he do to get the king of Assyria to do that? Verse 8, he took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house and sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria heeded him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried its people captive to Kir and killed Rezin. Now notice the result here. The result is success. Damascus is crushed. Rezin is killed. The Syrians are taken captive to Kir. And then Ahaz, verse 10, went up to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser. And while he was there, he saw an altar. We're going to pause at that part and look at something else in 2 Chronicles 28. So turn there, 2 Chronicles 28, begin reading at verse 16. It says there, at the same time as this other event that was happening that we read about before in 2 Chronicles 28 about the huge defeat, at the same time King Ahaz sent to the kings of Assyria to help him, for again the Edomites had come, attacked Judah, and carried away captives. The Philistines also had invaded the cities of the lowland and of the south of Judah and had taken Beth Shemesh, Ajalon, Gederoth, Soko with its villages, Timnah with its villages, and Gimzo with its villages, and they dwelt there. For the Lord brought Judah low because of Ahaz king of Israel, for he had encouraged moral decline in Judah and had been continually unfaithful to the Lord. Also Tiglath-Pileser king of Assyria came to him and distressed him and did not assist him. For Ahaz took part of the treasures from the house of the Lord, from the house of the king, and from the leaders, and he gave it to the king of Assyria, but he did not help him. You see, evidently, there are other enemies that are attacking, the Edomites, verse 17, and the Philistines, verse 18. And the reason is, God brought Judah low because of Ahaz, how he encouraged moral decline in Judah and continual unfaithfulness to the Lord. And then he took God's treasures and gave them to the Assyrians in a vain attempt to get help, verse 21. Now, also he took the king's treasures and the leader's treasures. That makes me think that possibly this was after the first bid to get help, that he got help from Tiglath-Pileser, and now he's gathering up money from some other place, namely some of the leaders, in the hope that, well, it worked once, hopefully it'll work again. And Tiglath-Pileser didn't do it. Instead, he troubled him, verse 20. Now you might say, well, that just looks sort of contradictory. But notice, we have two different sets of enemies here. In the one case, it was Israel and Syria, and Tiglath-Pileser helped on that one. In the other case, it was the Philistines and the Edomites, and Tiglath-Pileser did not help. And I think what's going on there likely is Tiglath-Pileser didn't care if these two little kingdoms were fighting each other, namely the Philistines and the Edomites fighting the southern kingdom of Judah. That's fine. Let them make themselves weak. And if Ahaz is going to pay him to come fight against the northern kingdom, well, that's fine too, because he was probably wanting to come down there anyway, and if he can get paid for it, that's great. Now, notice what happens. Go back to 2 Kings chapter 16, how that unfaithfulness leads to more sin. Remember that Ahaz went up to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, that's verse 10 of 2 Kings 16, and when he was there, he saw an altar there and had a copy made of that altar in Jerusalem. He sent specifications back home to Urijah the priest to have one made in Jerusalem. And verse 12 and 13, he made offerings on the new altar when he got home. And verse 14, he moved God's bronze altar out of the way. I mean, after all, God's altar is still important, but it's not central anymore. Doesn't that remind you of how people do today? Oh, yes, what God says is important, but it's not central, it's not sufficient, it's not good enough. And so the new procedure, verse 15, is the new altar that he has made is for all the offerings, and the bronze altar is for him to inquire by, as if God would listen to inquiries by one who repudiated his altar. Not only that, Ahaz destroyed temple instruments, verse 17 and following, because of the king of Assyria. He cut off panels of carts. The brazen oxen were a source for bronze. He removed the Sabbath pavilion. He removed the king's outer entrance. He cut in pieces the articles of the temple and shut it, forcing the people to worship at places he devised. You can find that in 2 Chronicles 28, verses 24 and 25. And so you can see that in his distress, he became more unfaithful. He sacrificed to the gods of Syria because he noticed that the gods of Syria had helped them. 2 Chronicles 28, verse 22. But had he forgotten something? When Tiglath-Pileser came against Syria, did the gods of Syria help them? No. Tiglath-Pileser crushed the Syrians. You see, people love to take partial evidence. They love to take certain facts that are true, that support an idea they have, and ignore other facts that show that idea that they have is false. Well, let's just forget these inconvenient facts over here that show the idea is false. Let's just focus on these here that would fit in with it being true. That's what Ahaz was doing. That's what many people do. You can choose to base actions on all the facts. You can ask God to show you all the things you need to know so you can be wise. Or you can say, this is what I want to do, and I am going to shut my eyes to these facts over here because they are so inconvenient. I would rather look at these. Then I can feel totally happy pursuing this course that I've decided. That is the attitude of Ahaz. Now let's turn to Isaiah chapter 8. See, Isaiah chapter 8 is simply a continuation of Isaiah chapter 7. Moreover, the Lord said to me, take a large scroll and write on it with a man's pen concerning Maher Shalal Hashbaz. And I will take for myself faithful witnesses to record Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jerubbaal. Then I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and bore a son. Then the Lord said to me, call his name Maher Shalal Hashbaz. For before the child shall have knowledge to cry my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be taken away before the king of Assyria. Now notice in verses 1 to 4, you have a prophecy of judgment that is soon going to fall. And this prophetic son, his name is prophetic. This Maher Shalal Hashbaz means speed the spoil, hasten the booty. That sounds scary, doesn't it? The implication is there's a coming disaster. And notice, there is no offer of deliverance through faith. Contrast with chapter 7, verses 7 to 9. If you squander opportunity that God has given you, you have no guarantee of a future opportunity. So verses 1 and 2, write it in a public record with large detail, and this is going to happen soon. How do we know? Because it's going to happen before this conceived child can talk and say, my father and my mother. So the destruction on the north is coming far sooner than 65 years. Remember in chapter 7, within 65 years, he didn't say it would be 65 years, but within 65 years. So you see, he could have heard that and said, well, you know, that's not soon enough for me. I've got to do something else. Instead of trusting in God. And now, after he's made the wrong choice, then he hears that, oh, something is going to happen before the conceived child reaches the age that he can say, my father and my mother. Now notice, having refused God's offer to believe, chapter 7, verse 9, Ahaz had looked to Assyria for help against his enemies. We saw that in 2 Kings chapter 16. And now Assyria is coming against whom? Against Israel and Judah. That is a big problem. The king of Assyria is coming. Verse 6. Inasmuch as these people refuse the waters of Shiloh that flow softly, and rejoice in reason and in Remaliah's son, now therefore, behold, the Lord is going to do something. What is he talking about? He refused the waters of Shiloh. In other words, they refused what came from God, the waters of Shiloh. Shiloh was the place where the tabernacle was set up before the division of the land for the 12 tribes. It was the place where Samuel's early life was spent. 1 Samuel 1 through 4. In other words, God gave verbal instructions, and you might say there was milder chastisement. But if you despise the gentle waters of Shiloh that God gives at the early stages, what does God do? He says, okay, then you can have the waters of the mighty river come. See? Verse 7. Now therefore, behold, the Lord brings up over them the waters of the river, strong and mighty. The king of Assyria and all his glory, he will go up over all his channels and go over all his banks. He will pass through Judah. He will overflow and pass over. He will reach up to the neck. You get the picture? You see, the northern kingdom trusted in reason and Pekah to accomplish their goals. And the southern kingdom went to Assyria to accomplish their goals, to get help against the northern kingdom. And so God says, okay, you can have Assyria in his fullness. And the picture is what? A river in flood stage. You're going to get an overflowing river, not a calm stream. Notice this river will conquer the northern kingdom. It's a strong river and will overflow its banks, so it's flood stage. And it will nearly overwhelm Judah because it's going to pass through Judah and reach to the neck. How would you like to be standing somewhere and a river in flood stage reaches to your neck? You'd feel pretty vulnerable, wouldn't you? Those who refuse the gracious and gentle administration of Jehovah will feel the torrential power of the Assyrian armies. And then he concludes with a different picture there in verse 8b. And the stretching out of his wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. In other words, he pictures him as a huge bird of prey. But, interestingly enough, in the prospect of such disaster, God would still be with his people. He says, will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. And Emmanuel means God with us. Now, it doesn't sound like God is with us, does it? Let's look at it a little more. You see, this judgment is actually coming on Emmanuel's land, God with us land. And you can see a chiasm here. Verse 8b, God with us. And then down at 10b, it says, again, God with us. And then that's the outer boundary. Then you come down from the top. Verse 9b, you're supposed to give ear, in other words, hear words. And then up from the bottom, 10b, speak. In other words, you're going to be speaking words. So there's something about hearing words and then something about speaking words. And then right in the middle, 9c and 10a, you've got gird but be broken, and it repeats it. And then take counsel that fails. So you see, right as the focal point is your preparations and your plans will fail. Now, whose preparations? He's talking about the preparations and plans of those who have come in and crushed the nation. In other words, this judgment that God is bringing is not permanent. The enemies of God's people will ultimately be crushed, verse 10b. In spite of the power of the enemies, they will eventually be shattered. In other words, attempt to be ready, but be shattered anyway. Take counsel and find it fruitless. Your human counsel will turn to nothing. You see, God is going to use that nation, those peoples, to come in and administer justice to his people. But at the appropriate time, God is God is going to cause a stop to the activities of those wicked nations, and all the schemes that they might devise to keep on doing it aren't going to work. And that brings us to verse 11. Verses 11 through 15, don't think like this people thinks. For the Lord spoke thus to me with a strong hand and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, do not say a conspiracy concerning all that this people call a conspiracy, nor be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. The Lord of hosts, him you shall hallow. Let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. He will be as a sanctuary, but a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, as a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble. They shall fall and be broken, be snared and taken. Notice there are two choices. The directives in verses 12 and 13 are speaking to Isaiah and to his devout followers. Here's what you're supposed to do. The ones who are truly following God. You can have a wrong fear, verse 12, and that is a fear of the circumstances. Don't speak of a conspiracy. Don't be afraid of their threats. You see, we all tend to have wrong fears. We tend to fear the wrong things. The correct fear, verse 13, is God himself. In other words, the God of hosts, the Lord of hosts. And remember, that means the Lord of armies. Here is the one who's really in control. You shall sanctify him. In other words, set him apart. God is high and holy. God is powerful. And you fear him. He shall be your fear and dread. It repeats the same verbs that you have in verse 12. So instead of fearing your circumstances, fear God. Be afraid of doing something that would be counter to what he wants done. So one of two results will happen. If you have God as your fear and your dread, instead of the circumstances, then he will be a sanctuary to you, verse 14. A sanctuary is where they met God. It's a holy place. It was a place of safety. For example, somebody could go and flee to the sanctuary and grab hold of the horns of the altar, and he wasn't supposed to be killed there. But if you don't have God as your sanctuary, as your fear and dread, then he will be your stumbling block, and he will actually produce disaster for you. He will be a stone of stumbling and rock of offense, a trap and a snare to both the northern and southern kingdom, and as a result, many will stumble, be broken, snared, and captured. Now, as we read in the New Testament, we find out that Jesus is the ultimate sanctuary or stumbling block. So, what are the directions for Isaiah and his response, verses 16 to 18? The directions are, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait on the Lord, who hides his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. Here am I and the children whom the Lord has given me. We are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells in Mount Zion. He's saying, bind the testimony, seal the law, and it's a masculine singular in verse 16. In other words, Isaiah is supposed to do this. Isaiah is to tie up God's words so that later, when the prophecy is fulfilled, he can point to the earlier writing and say, see, here's what God said back then. And his response is found in verses 17 and 18. I will wait on God. In other words, even though he hides from Jacob, it's like as if he is withdrawing his protection from Jacob. I will wait on God. And I will hope in him. You see, he's simply waiting for what God is going to do. But not only that, I will hope in him, confident that God will decisively act. And then verse 18, I and my family are at the disposal of the one who dwells in Mount Zion. In other words, God is right there, but Israel doesn't see it. You see, the spiritual person can see what is not visible to the natural eye. He can understand what God is doing, and so he knows that God is right there, and so he can say, I and my family are at the disposal of the one who dwells in Mount Zion. And then there's some general instructions in verses 19 to 22. And when they say to you, seek those who are mediums and wizards, who mutter, who whisper and mutter, should not a people seek their God? Should they seek the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony, if they do not speak according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. They will pass through it hard-pressed and hungry, and it shall happen when they are hungry that they will be enraged and curse their king and their God and look upward. Then they will look to the earth and see trouble and darkness, gloom of anguish, and they will be driven into darkness. So what's he saying? Don't seek false help. You see how that's relevant particularly to Ahaz? The written word will define what is false. People might want to know what is false. Here's how to find out. Study the written word that God has written, verse 20. And those who seek the false will be hungry, enraged, and will curse their king and their God or their gods, whichever. And they will be driven to deeper darkness. You see, in frightening events, God will either be our stumbling block or our sanctuary. Now notice the contrast. The confusion of those who reject God. They fear their circumstances. They take desperate measures trying to make things work, but they're futile. It doesn't really help. And then they get worse and worse in the process. And God's message through Isaiah is very sobering. Don't fear your circumstances. That's what it's so easy to do. Instead, fear God and think like He thinks. How can you think like He thinks? It's you have to spend time immersing yourself with the Word of God, absorbing what He says and seeing His acts in history. And then you can see His power and His glory. You can see with clarity. And then you have the honor of being at the disposal of God. Isaiah said, here am I and my children to be signs and wonders in Israel. Well, what's happening to King Ahaz? If you turn back to 2 Kings chapter 16, and you find that after he had removed those things from the temple, done all that wicked stuff, verse 19 it says, now the rest of the acts of Ahaz which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Ahaz rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. Then Hezekiah his son reigned in his place. But if you glance at 2 Chronicles 28, verse 27, you find another detail. It says there, Ahaz rested with his fathers, and they buried him in the city in Jerusalem, but they did not bring him into the tombs of the kings of Israel. Then Hezekiah his son reigned in his place. The people recognized Ahaz as a wretched king, and they did not bury him with the kings. So what do we learn as we think about the life of Ahaz? One of the lessons we learn is that when people reject truth, they become utterly foolish. They make additional foolish and unproductive choices. In fact, choices that are counterproductive that actually produce more bad stuff. Remember, Ahaz imported the Syrian altar because of the Syrian victories, but neglected the fact that the Syrian gods did not help the Syrians against Assyria. And then, when someone rejects truth, they think they can compensate for their disobedience by offering God specific obedience in certain areas. You know, like he took this altar of God, moved it off to the side. Okay, we're not going to offer our sacrifices there. And now we'll save this altar to inquire of God by. Well, isn't that spiritual? We'll use the altar to inquire of God. That's how people think. And when you reject truth, you will falsely assume you can still call on God for help on your own terms. See, he saved that altar to inquire of God by. And there's the temptation and the fact that they will think that they have devised a solution that will be better than doing what God said. Ahaz destroyed the temple instruments and shut the temple, making alternate altars. So you see the ultimate folly. Either you're going to look at your circumstances and fear them and God will become your stumbling block because he will not do things the way you think he ought to do it. So, like, people don't like God then. Or you will take the attitude, instead of fearing our circumstances, we are going to fear God and hallow him and have as our fear that we would be afraid to do anything that would be disobedient to him and displeasing to him, and then he will become our sanctuary. And Ahaz flunked out. He refused to fear God. Instead, he feared his circumstances, and God became his stumbling block. Isaiah gave the message of God, but Isaiah also listened to the message of God to him. And so he hallowed God and feared God, and then he said, I and my children are at the disposal of God to be signs and wonders in Israel, and I will wait for him. May the Lord bless you.